Ubuntu is more than just a Linux distribution. It's an attempt to rewrite who gets to own computing. This is the story of what happens when a group of free software believers and a millionaire from South Africa decide to build not just another distro, but a polished, global operating system based on an idea called humanity toward others. It is one of the most unusual stories in modern tech. A story about how a community that hated corporate control ended up relying on a company to package its freedom. A project that promised openness and transparency, then faced accusations of spying, fragmentation and centralization. A system that started as a rebellion and became, in many ways, the new establishment. And as you'll see, everything is not as it seems. You'll hear about secret meetings, impossible promises, battles over design, privacy scandals, failed phone dreams, power struggles over app stores, and at the very end, you'll decide for yourself. Did Ubuntu save the Linux desktop, or did it quietly turn it into something else? Welcome to the story of Ubuntu. It starts in London. A group of around 17 free software professionals gather in a rented room. They have a simple observation. GNU Linux is everywhere, except where normal people can touch it. It runs on servers, clusters, and supercomputers. But if you walk into a PC shop and ask for a machine with a free operating system pre-installed, you hit a wall. They don't have a brand yet. Internally, they joke and call the project the Super Secret Debian Startup and register a placeholder domain, nonameyet.com. The idea is sharp. Take Debian's rock-solid base and turn it into something ordinary users can actually install and live in. Ship it regularly. Support it professionally. Keep it free. At the center is Mark Shuttleworth. He has sold a security company, made enough money to fund a serious experiment, trained as a cosmonaut, and spent time on the International Space Station. He is also a Debian developer, so he knows the strengths and weaknesses of the ecosystem from the inside. Now he wants to build a world-class experience for ordinary desktop users on top of free software. They choose a name from an African concept, Ubuntu. It means humanity toward others. It's not a technical word at all, but that's the point. It tells the world what this project wants to stand for, software that is free to get, free to share, and rooted in the idea that people matter more than products. Then they start building. Before the first release even ships, Shuttleworth files something that reads like a manifesto disguised as a bug report. Bug 1. Microsoft has a majority market share in the new desktop PC marketplace. The steps to reproduce are simple. Visit any PC store and try to buy a machine without proprietary software. The expected result is that most computers should ship with free software instead. To this group, that situation isn't just a business reality, it's a defect in how the world works. Ubuntu is their attempt to fix it. In October 2004, they ship their first release, Ubuntu 4.1, Warty Warthog. The codename is a joke about rough edges, but for many users it's the first time Linux feels like a coherent product. You burn the CD, boot it, and you're met with a GNOME desktop that looks modern, detects your hardware, and includes a normal set of applications. For the first time, non-experts can install a Linux system without needing a friend who knows computers. Ubuntu makes one promise that changes everything, a new release every 6 months, April and October. No long stalls, no unpredictable freezes, just a steady drumbeat of updates. Over time, that schedule becomes the spine of the project. Developers can aim for specific trains. Companies can plan deployments. Users start to treat Ubuntu's calendar like clockwork. To guarantee that this experiment doesn't vanish, Shuttleworth funds the Ubuntu Foundation with millions of dollars. Canonical hires people around the world to work full-time on packaging, infrastructure, and support. The OS is free, the money comes from services. The bug has been logged. Now they need to ship enough releases to make it hurt. Ubuntu's early mission exposed something deeper about computing. One world, split across too many platforms. Different systems, duplicated work, and the same problems solved over and over again. And interestingly, that tension never really disappeared. Even today, building software across Android, iOS, desktop, and the web, and the back-end services that power them often means maintaining separate codebases, carrying the same bugs in four different places, and fixing the same logic four different times. I've been exploring Kotlin, a programming language created by JetBrains, today's sponsor, and it comes with multi-platform built-in, a technology that lets you share real production code across Android, iOS, desktop, and the web, and even server-side applications with KTOR. Not through a big rewrite, but by reusing the core logic you already have. And with Compose Multiplatform, you can share modern, declarative UI code across platforms too, while still keeping native control where it matters. The important part is, this isn't a closed ecosystem. Kotlin works with your existing Java and Swift code, and Google itself now officially supports sharing business logic between Android and iOS using KMP. And beyond multi-platform development, Kotlin is also a solid choice for server-side work. It's officially supported by Spring and works seamlessly with your existing Java backend. It's a natural JVM upgrade, adding coroutines and null safety for faster, safer development. Check out Kotlin Multiplatform and Kotlin for backend development at kotlinlang.org. Now, Ubuntu's challenge wasn't just shipping releases. It was doing it under the eyes of the entire world. From day one, Ubuntu chooses public mess over quiet control. Shuttleworth describes the project as a fishbowl. Decisions, arguments, and mistakes are all visible to anyone who cares to look. Ugly debates about default wallpapers or artwork happen on public mailing lists, not in private boardrooms. To stop that transparency from turning into pure chaos, they write a code of conduct. It tells contributors how to disagree without turning every thread into a flame war. It reminds them that finding common ground and keeping communication healthy matters more, in the long run, than winning any single technical argument. They also create a community council and a technical board. These bodies can settle disputes, approve new leaders, and keep the project pointed in a consistent direction. Ubuntu is built around a benevolent dictator in Shuttleworth, but it also has formal paths for volunteers to influence decisions. In the early years, that mix works. Canonical brings money, infrastructure, and marketing. The community brings energy, local advocacy, and countless small contributions. Both sides need each other, and both sides know it. But the more successful Ubuntu becomes, the more that balance will be tested. Through the late 2000s, Ubuntu starts to feel less like an experiment and more like the default Linux for human beings. New flavors appear: Kubuntu with KDE, Subuntu with a lighter desktop, Edubuntu for classrooms, Ubuntu Studio for audio and video work. Each one blends the same Ubuntu base with a different personality. Local loco teams organize install parties, translation sprints, and meetups. At the same time, Ubuntu spreads quietly into server rooms. A server edition appears with tools for RAID, LVM, and virtualization. As new technologies like cloud computing and OpenStack emerge, Ubuntu quickly positions itself as a natural base for them. It's modern, frequently updated, and well documented. On the desktop, Ubuntu is suddenly everywhere. On magazine covers, in tutorials, in dual-boot laptops, in schools and internet cafes. For a lot of people, trying Linux now means installing Ubuntu. Bug one looks a little less impossible. Then Canonical decides that good Linux isn't enough. They want something bigger. For years, Ubuntu has shipped with the GNOME 2 desktop, panels at the top and bottom, menus for applications and places, a layout familiar to anyone who touched Linux in the 2000s. Then Canonical announces Unity. Unity moves the launcher to the left side. It replaces the old menus with a full-screen dash. It pushes global menus to the top panel. It aims for clean lines, big targets, and a single design language that can stretch from laptops to tablets and TVs. From Canonical's point of view, this is essential. If free software wants to be taken seriously by ordinary users, it needs opinionated design, something Shuttleworth says in plain language in his forewords and talks. Unity is how Ubuntu stops being just Linux with nicer packaging and becomes its own thing. But the community reaction is explosive. Some users love it. Many hate it. People who have spent years investing in GNOME feel blindsided. They accuse Canonical of dictating changes from above. Blogs fill with Unity rants. Other distributions distance themselves. The argument stops being about window buttons and launchers and becomes a deeper question: who owns the desktop, the company, or the community? Unity is also a signal of something bigger, convergence. Canonical's vision is one Ubuntu that runs everywhere: phones, tablets, desktops, TV. Unity will adapt to each form factor. Code will be shared. Components like the HUD and Dash will tie it all together. On paper, it looks like the future. In reality, it leads straight into the next set of battles. As Unity beds in, Canonical makes a quieter change that will define how many people see Ubuntu for years. The Dash, Ubuntu's central search box, begins pulling in results from Amazon. When you type to look for a local file or app, product suggestions appear alongside it. The queries are sent to Canonical's servers and forwarded on. From Canonical's side, this is framed as harmless and even useful, a way to help users discover things and to generate revenue without charging for the OS. From the community's side, it feels like a betrayal. Desktop search, which people assume is purely local, is suddenly tied to an online affiliate program. Privacy advocates call it adware. Users who once recommended Ubuntu without hesitation now add warnings. The controversy takes on a life of its own. it becomes a symbol of a deeper fear, that the project that once stood as a clean, user-first alternative is drifting into the same patterns as proprietary vendors. Eventually, Canonical backs down. The feature is disabled by default and when removed. But the trust damage is done. A line has been crossed, and people remember. Unity was never just about desktops. It was part of a larger bet: Ubuntu Phone, Ubuntu on tablets, Ubuntu TVs, and a new display server called Mir. While the rest of the Linux world gravitates toward Wayland as the successor to X11, Canonical chooses to build Mir instead. The official explanation is that Mir will be better suited for convergence, performance, and security. For many outside Canonical, it looks like unilateral fragmentation. Toolkit and compositor developers now face X, Wayland, and Mir. Ubuntu Phone launches on a handful of devices. The interface is sleek and gesture-driven. There are fans, but no breakout success. Then Canonical unveils Ubuntu Edge, a high-end superphone that docks into a full desktop experience. The crowdfunding campaign raises a record-breaking amount for its time, but still falls short of an enormous target. The phone never ships. For years, engineers inside Canonical continue working on Unity 8, Mir, and Ubuntu Touch, trying to bring the convergence dream to life, but the market has made other choices. Android and iOS are locked in. OEM and carriers stick with what sells. Outside the Ubuntu bubble, almost nobody is demanding a converged phone. Desktop device. In 2017, Canonical cuts its losses. Shuttleworth announces that Ubuntu will drop Unity, stop work on the Foam and Convergence UI, and return to the GNOME desktop. Mir is repositioned away from the traditional desktop stack. The grand experiment is over. For supporters of convergence, it's a gut punch. For longtime critics, it's vindication. For Canonical, it's survival. Bug 1, meanwhile, gets marked as fixed. Not because Ubuntu has won the desktop, but because the world has changed. Android, Chrome OS, and other open-source-based systems now occupy much of the personal computing space. The original framing of a Windows-only world no longer fits. The war, at least as they defined it in 2004, is over. While the phone dream is collapsing, another story is unfolding in the background: the future of how software is delivered on Ubuntu. Snaps arrive. On paper, it's a smart answer to old problems like dependency hell and manual upgrades. In practice, it opens a new front in the control debate. The Snap tools are open source. But the main Snap store, the place where most users actually get snaps, is run by Canonical. Alternative stores exist in theory, but they're not first-class citizens. When Ubuntu quietly switches some apps, like Chromium, from traditional deb packages to Snap stubs that pull from the store, other distributions react. Linux Mint, for example, blocks Snapped by default and accuses Canonical of sneaking a proprietary-feeling app delivery model into the wider ecosystem. Fake applications, including bogus cryptocurrency wallets, appear in the store. Users install them, assuming they are safe, because they show up in Ubuntu's software center. Some report losing funds after trusting what looks like an official offering. Canonical responds by tightening reviews, especially around finance, and promises better moderation. But the incidents prove a point critics have been making all along: when one company controls the main store, its mistakes affect everyone. The gamble is clear. Snaps and Ubuntu Core give Ubuntu a strong story for devices, appliances, and enterprise deployments. But they also shift power toward Canonical at a time when many in the Linux world are wary of exactly that. While the desktop and packaging battles play out in public, Ubuntu is quietly winning somewhere else: the cloud. Ubuntu Server becomes the base OS for a huge percentage of OpenStack installations. Major cloud providers like AWS, Azure, and Google Cloud offer official Ubuntu images as first-class options. Developers spin up Ubuntu VMs for everything from hobby projects to global SaaS platforms. Canonical leans into this. It builds products and services around OpenStack, Kubernetes, and bare metal provisioning. It launches Ubuntu Pro, bundling extended security maintenance, live patching, and compliance tooling into a subscription that enterprises can buy. By the mid-2020, a huge portion of the internet is either running directly on Ubuntu or relying on services that do. When Canonical has archive or security server outages, people feel it. Failed installs, broken updates, and CI crashes ripple across organizations and other distributions that mirror Ubuntu. What started as just another Linux has become part of the critical infrastructure. Ubuntu never took the desktop away from Windows or Mac OS. But on servers, in clouds, and on devices, it did something quieter. It became the default choice in places most users never see. So was Ubuntu good or bad for open source? On one side, Ubuntu took the Linux desktop from a world of arcane installers and random ISOs to a coherent, regular, human-friendly platform. It helped millions of people touch Linux for the first time, It pushed the free software world to care about design, documentation, and predictability. It gave projects like OpenStack, cloud providers, and device makers a safe base to build on. On the other side, Ubuntu introduced a strong corporate center into a culture that defined itself against corporate control. It fought public battles over privacy with the Amazon Dash Search. It fragmented the display stack with Mir. It tried to reshape the desktop with Unity in ways many users resented. It now runs a central app store that briefly allowed malicious wallets to drain people's money. It sells extended security and management on top of community code in ways some see as necessary, and others see as enclosure. And somewhere in between are all the people who just installed Ubuntu to get work done, and never think about any of this.